Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I am your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement to put the rights of children before the desires of adults. And if we did that, we would see not just healthy, flourishing children, but a healthy, flourishing society. And I'm going to talk a little bit with my engagement director, Patience Sunny, today about a bombshell of a report on the abortion pill. But first, I just wanted to take a moment and talk about a little bit of Bible time. You know, that's how we try to kick things off here at Them Before Us. And this time it's a little bit different. It doesn't necessarily have a child-centric focus. But I've got a couple wonderful friends. You know, I'm now in my late 40s, and I've got some wonderful friends who are struggling with serious health issues that are sudden and worrisome. And I shared this with one of them, and it was the thing that got me through a really dark time in my life. And it's from Lamentations chapter 3. And you are lamenting. I mean, there is a place to lament. There is a place to complain even to the Lord. And I remember I needed this passage more than I needed food. I craved it more than I wanted water. I've never really had that experience before, but there's something about that desperation where you cannot help yourself that drives you to the Word of God. And this one was particularly helpful to me. It says, I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall. I mean, these are times where you're bitter and it's like it leaves such a terrible taste in your mouth. I well remember them, and my soul is downcast within me. I mean, these times of great trial can level you. But then the author says, but this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. And that's how it feels when you are right on the edge of those horrible trials. You feel like it can consume you, but because of the Lord's great love, it keeps you from being consumed. For his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. So if that's where you are today, if you're in a situation with your health, with your children, with your marriage, with your finances, where you feel like you can do nothing for yourself, where you feel like you are being ground into the dirt, turn to the Lord, consume his word. I'd say open scripture and read until God speaks to you and let it feed your soul so that you can wait for him, because that's later on, that you will wait for the Lord because he is your portion. You don't wait for the paycheck. You don't wait for the different prognosis. You don't wait for your child to return. You wait for the Lord. He is your portion, and he will give you all good things in due time. Well, we are going to transition and talk about this bombshell that is really the only way to put this new report that just came out earlier this week, published by our friends at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, on the actual health impacts of the abortion pill. And this is something that has been marketed to women as being as safe as Tylenol, but that is not the reality. And we now have massive amounts of undisputable data that talks about the incredible health risks to women who are taking the abortion pill. So I'm going to turn it over to our engagement director, Patience Sunny. Patience, tell us a little bit about what this report found.
Yeah, so this report is really astounding. It's the first of its kind in that it's looking at real-world health data. So the studies that the abortion industry points to and that the FDA points to saying that the abortion pill is safer than Tylenol, these were highly controlled clinical studies from about 40 years ago, and using a much smaller sample size than this study uses. This study looks at over 865,000 prescribed cases of mifepristone. They're looking at HIPAA compliance analysis of health insurance claims, of this health insurance claims database, where they're looking at anytime mifepristone is prescribed and then looking at the 40-day period following that, to watch for adverse events directly resulting from that abortion pill. And they found that 10.9%, just under one in nine women who used the abortion pill experienced at least one serious adverse event. So these are things like sepsis, infection, hemorrhaging, other life-threatening instances. So very serious complications that land people in the emergency room.
So we're not talking about headaches. We're not talking about mild cramps here. We're talking about things that send women to the ER. And I believe that the report also covered some of those more mild symptoms, but they're like, we're not even going to talk about that because the severe symptoms are so dramatically overrepresented when it comes to what we were told this does. So patients, just give us the contrast here. What did they say were the risks of severe complications? And what, based on this massive data pool, are the actual risk of severe complications?
Yeah, so they said it was a less than 1% chance of severe complications. That was the data that they were using based on a 42-year-old study, highly controlled clinical setting. And the real-world data shows that there's a 10% chance, over 10% chance of severe complications. That's a pretty risky medication if almost 1 in 9 women are ending up in the emergency room because they've taken it. And especially striking because chemical abortions, the abortion pill, currently counts for about 2/3 of the abortions committed in the United States. This is a very common procedure, and it's promoted by the abortion industry as something that's perfectly safe, perfectly normal, and should be available by mail order, and currently is, because under both the Obama and the Biden administration, the FDA REMS guidelines that had been in place for the abortion pill were completely walked back to the point that an in-person visit is no longer required. You don't have to leave your home to get the abortion pill. You don't have to be in a state where abortion is legal to get the abortion pill. And that's been a huge issue, is states with full abortion bans are still seeing abortions taking place because mail order abortions are available. So a woman can get on a call with a group like Just the Pill, get it sent to her home, and commit that abortion in her own home, in her own bathroom, with these groups encouraging her, don't tell the ER why you're really there, which does change how they go about treatment. Because if it's being caused, if what she's experiencing was induced by a medication as opposed to a natural miscarriage, those are two different scenarios that need to be handled differently in order for her health and safety to be maintained.
Okay, so we had these very high profile cases of a couple women who died, like in Georgia or in Texas, a couple years ago. And the big claim was, oh, this is because of the pro-life laws and the doctors, they could not administer the kind of life-saving services that these women needed to do a DNC. But many of those cases were women that had already tried to administer their own chemical abortion at home and then had to go to the emergency room. And then it was blamed on pro-life laws. And when in reality, you know, we are so far away from this is a decision between a woman and her doctor. It is now a decision between a woman and her mailbox. Like, that's really what's going on. And like you said, we're talking about 2/3 of abortions in this country are now chemical abortions, where women are taking these pills, often at home, often alone, and then suffering these severe consequences, and then going to the hospital and not even being able to, well, being advised not to sound the alarm about what led her to be in that place where she is hemorrhaging, or when she now has an incomplete embryonic body in her that is now creating an infection or sometimes sepsis. So patients, just, this is not how it always was. You alluded to this a little bit, but this pill has been around for about 20 years, but it used to be highly controlled. So tell me, what kind of provisions or protections or protocols used to be in place before a woman could take the abortion pill, and contrast that to how women generally get it today?
Yeah, so over the years, the requirements really have been walked back. When the abortion pill was first legalized in the United States under the Clinton administration, women couldn't use the abortion pill if they were past 7 weeks gestation, because there was an understanding that this might lead to an incomplete abortion if you're using it too late in pregnancy. That was bumped to 10 weeks under the Obama administration, and the Biden administration maintains that 10 weeks. But the bigger thing that got walked back under both the Obama and the Biden administration was these REMS protocols, where when a drug is considered high risk, the FDA has regulations in place requiring an in-person visit and in-person follow-up. And both of those things were walked back so that now there's no exam, there's no confirmation of gestational age, there's no confirmation that she's even pregnant, there's no confirmation that the pregnancy isn't ectopic, which is something that cannot be addressed by the abortion pill. The abortion pill, blocks progesterone to the embryo, essentially starving it. And then the second pill causes the body to go into labor. And an ectopic pregnancy is not resolved by either of those things. So in that case, you could have a woman who has a continuing ectopic pregnancy who thinks that that has been dealt with, that she's no longer pregnant, and is in a life-threatening situation as a direct result of that. So these regulations that were keeping women as safe as they can be while undergoing an abortion have been removed by the FDA, so that now the most common way to get the abortion pill is through a telehealth appointment. And you know, it's promoted as convenient and safe, and you know, this is a way for women who are in distress to not have to go out and see anyone in person. But that actually creates some really dangerous situations, not just from the perspective of physical risk, but also we're not confirming who's getting these pills. You know, there was a time when the woman had to take the first abortion pill in the presence of her doctor. And now someone can order them via mail. And there have been instances of people ordering the abortion pill with the intention of giving it to someone else. And we're going to see more of this. There's also instances of the abortion industry covering up pretty horrific abuse. And the gift that this is to abusers is genuinely horrifying.
I was about to say, like, we already have people that are trafficking young women, abusing young women, taking them for a surgical abortion, but at least there, they actually have to be face-to-face. At least there, like, somebody over the table or the reception desk can be like, this doesn't seem right. Like, something doesn't seem right here. But now when you can bypass all of the in-person, like, checks and balances on this, of course, this is just going to create a highway of people to cover up crimes against children. So, like, there are so many ways that this abortion pill is... Okay, so let's just be very clear. This report talks about the detrimental effects on women's health. Now, we think that all abortion pills should be illegal because they're always going to kill children. But I'll tell you what, a lot of that does not, that kind of talk does not resonate with a huge swath of the country that doesn't believe that life begins at conception, that believes the lie that this is just a clump of cells. But what often will get their attention is negative or adverse health events for women, and especially when the drug company or the FDA themselves is lying to women about the risks. So patients, if you could just speculate, what do you hope is going to happen in the wake of this brand new, unassailable data on how the abortion pill is harming women, very often to the point of getting them to a life-threatening situation?
Yeah, so our hope would be that the FDA takes a look at this data and says, okay, first of all, we have to put REMS back in place, but then also takes it a step further and says, maybe we should take this off the market entirely. And that would be what we would really hope for ultimately. But first, even just to have the REMS protocols back in place, to require that in-person visit that helps prevent abuse, helps prevent some of these additional physical complications. But there are instances where the FDA has looked at real-world data on a drug and taken it off the market because now they have a non-controlled, non-clinical setting, and they're actually seeing the effects. And so we would hope that they would look at this data and come to a similar conclusion, say, hey, this drug is not nearly as safe as we've been telling people it is. It's not nearly as harmless as we've claimed, and we need to reevaluate our own data. And what's great is that this is a completely repeatable study. They're looking at actual insurance claims, and it's a combination of private insurance and Medicaid, so information that the FDA has very easy access to, and really making it so that the FDA has to look at that data and say, this is a serious problem.
Well, we are grateful for reality to trump ideology, and we pray it is going to lead to greater protections for women and children. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I am glad that you're with us. There is a lot happening in the world of child protection. And obviously, we just talked about the baby-taking industry of abortion and how chemical abortion pills are destroying not just the lives of children, but very, very often the health of women and mothers as well. But now we're going to turn our attention to the baby making industry. And I'm going to give you a peek into one of the most fascinating interviews that we've conducted at Them Before Us with a gentleman named Ari Shulman. Ari is the editor of The New Atlantis, a journal of technology and society, and a fellow at the Cosmos Ventures. His writing appears in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Atlantic, First Things, Slate. I mean, he is a prolific writer, but what he's going to talk with us about today that we are going to let you have a listen into is this terrible dystopic practice of not IVF, not in vitro fertilization, but IVG, in vitro gametogenesis. This is not taking a sperm cell and an egg cell from a man and a woman and making a baby. This is taking a skin cell or some saliva or a blood cell or a hair follicle and turning it into a sperm or egg cell so that you can make a baby. And I thought I knew about IVG. I didn't, not until I listened to this interview with Ari. So do what you can to listen to this in its entirety, because you have to know what is going on. You have to know where the world of big fertility is going and how it's going to harm children.
Today's guest joins us to chat about the future of IVF. Ari Shulman is editor of The New Atlantis, a journal of technology and society, and a fellow at Cosmos Ventures. Ari, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
To kick us off, can you just introduce yourself a little bit to our audience, maybe some of your educational career background, and then how did you get interested in artificial reproductive technologies?
Sure. So how I got interested in artificial reproductive technologies, it's a sort of a fifth level sidetrack from an original career track. So my educational background, I studied computer science and English at the University of Texas at Austin. And I was originally a physics major for a little while. I was like a science kid. That was my thing. And then I like to read on the side. But I was going down a science and technology track, and I was in a natural sciences honors program at the University of Texas. And we took a class. I personally was very interested in kind of philosophical. I didn't understand this at the time, but they were philosophical questions about science and technology. The kinds that you get answered through pop science books by Carl Sagan and Neil deGrasse Tyson and so forth. What is our place in the universe? Do we have free will? Are emotions real or an illusion? These kinds of things. So I was interested in those kinds of questions without really understanding that those were more philosophical questions than they really were properly scientific ones. So I was a science major, and we took a class on the singularity, which is the name for a hypothetical future in which technology accelerates at an ever-increasing rate. And so it compounds upon itself, and it reaches a kind of explosion point. So if you ever see hockey puck graphs of population explosion or global temperature or something like that, where it's kind of going along slowly and then it explodes, the idea is that technological progress is going to do that. And there will be a post-human future where we transcend the limitations of our biology, we overcome death, we overcome suffering and material scarcity, and we overcome all of these other limitations of our being. I took this class. I was, 19 or 20 years old. It was just a seminar on the side of other classes. We just kind of sat around chatting about things. And I was the only one in this class who thought that this sounded bad. And like a future where we lose something of ourselves. And it sounded to me like not only a bad, but just a meaningless future. A future where the context in which the things that mean things to us are no longer there. But I was the only one in my class who felt this way. And that was a bit of an alarm bell for me about the career path I was going down and the milieu that I was going to be a part of. I had a friend, my best friend since high school, Brian Boyd, who's now a moral theologian, who was interning at the New Atlantis, which is the science and technology magazine. He recommended that I go intern there as well. And I did many years ago now. And many years later, I'm now running it. But my interest in transhumanism grew out of that, right? So that's the singularity. The singularity is a prophecy about the future, a prediction. Transhumanism is the ideology that says that this is good and desirable and is something that we should be working towards. Assisted reproduction is a present version it's a small but I think significant present reality in which we are already going down a transhumanist path up to a point. I don't want to be too hasty and say that all assisted reproduction falls under that category, but there are certainly some assisted reproduction techniques that are problematic in that way because they represent the beginning of going beyond our human limitations.
So last fall, you wrote an article in the New York Times about how the world isn't ready for what comes after IVF. You wrote, "Consider in vitro gametogenesis, or IVG, a technology under development that would allow the creation of eggs or sperm from ordinary body tissue like skin cells. Men could become genetic mothers, women could be fathers, and people could be the offspring of 1, 3, 4, or any number of parents." So explain for our audience, what is IVG and how could it lead to genetically motherless or fatherless children or three-parent children?
Right. So in vitro gametogenesis is a fancy way of saying creating sperm and egg cells in a lab. So in vitro meaning in a lab or in a lab dish, as opposed to in the body. Gamete is the term for sperm and egg cells, and genesis meaning creation. So that is not possible right now, to my knowledge. You can create all kinds of cells in a lab. You can create various kinds of adult tissues from other adult stem cells. You can create, controversially about 20 years ago, began the ability to create essentially every cell in the body from embryonic stem cells. So you take human embryos and you manipulate the ways that they are. So every cell in our body has the same DNA, right? An embryonic stem cell allows you to create any adult tissue from that embryo. To my knowledge, at that time, the type of cell that was excluded from that was sperm and egg cells, which are different in structure. The sperm cells, I'm not a biologist here, so I'm stepping a little bit at the edge of my knowledge here, but I believe that the sperm cells don't contain the full complement of chromosomes. And so there were just these technical and biological limitations on the ability to create the cells that you use to create new life. This new technology, this new technique, it promises to be able to get around that. It's been done up to it's sort of done at a proof of concept level in a lab. It isn't quite yet ready for prime time, but it's at that sort of early stage. It opens up a bunch of new possibilities. I can kind of circle back and say a little bit more on this, but I think IVG is both troubling in itself, but it's also interesting and instructive because, unlike other assisted reproductive technologies, it's hard to find a precedent for it earlier in the human experience. It seems like a really novel thing. And it is novel because it would allow you to create an embryo and a baby and a person who has something other than one genetic mother and one genetic father, right? So for all of the sophisticated assisted reproduction technologies we've had before, like surrogacy or IVF or genetic selection, which involves sometimes kind of shifting our understanding of who parents are. We always understand that there is a single genetic mother and a single genetic father, even if that isn't the mother and father or the parents that are actually raising a child. This would change that. So it would allow, for example, same-sex couples to have a child that is the genetic child of both both members of the couple. It would also allow for what's called multiplex parenting, which is where you're combining the DNA from more than two people to create a baby. And I think it would also allow for singleton parenting, which is that you could become solely the genetic child, the genetic parent of a child. If you think through the implications of that, those kinds of arrangements have never existed before. Again, I would have to read up more fully on the technical details of this, but my understanding of this is that the way that this would work would be that you would be creating, you could create sperm and eggs from the adult cells of anyone. So you would have possibilities like somebody becoming, a man becoming the genetic mother of a child, or a woman becoming the genetic father of a child. I think there are actually chromosomal limitations that would limit some of those possibilities, but that's the sort of the path that you start going down, and that's the mechanism by which you would be able to do that.
It's interesting. We talked about, I think it was with Dr. Prentice as well. Our next question is about Dr. Prentice, but we talked about how with some of the gene editing that we're doing. You know, they're saying if we could edit out cerebral palsy, and you could clip that somehow out of someone's genes. That he said the problem is they were able to do something along those lines in the genes with one kind of disability, but then it made the embryos more prone to, I think it was like West Nile virus or something. It made them more prone to the next kind of disability or illness. So what's so fascinating about some of these thoughts about our technology is we just have no comprehension of what something like that would actually do to a human being. And it's kind of like human experimentation, right? So how, I guess there's so many ethical questions, but since it's hypothetical right now and the technology might just advance the point, well, you can't say we can't do it yet because we can't even do it. So, but what happens? Do we create humans and then we start talking about the ethics of it? That seems like what's happening with just IVF and things right now.
I think that's largely correct. I would say that's not an issue that I focus on greatly, just because it seems fairly clear to me that nobody really decides their position on these technologies based on those kinds of side effect issues. They are at most entry points for deeper and more underlying ethical questions. Right. This applies to tech debates of all kinds. When you're talking about nuclear power or raw milk or surrogacy, existing artificial reproduction technologies. Usually the way that people decide these things is that they either, you know, they believe that this is an underlying way, a way of advancing the human good, or a way of kind of disrupting the good and undertaking an immoral or a kind of hubristic act. Those side effects can become useful ways to kind of to think about and look at and see the manifestations of that underlying critique. But if you believe that the underlying act is good, the side effect issue is kind of a thing to manage. It doesn't usually become dispositive in these public debates unless there's really overwhelming and obvious side effects. But it is true that within the ordinary conventions of medical ethics, this is a form of human experimentation. I think you can credibly make the case that when you don't know what the kinds of side effects are, it constitutes a form of human experimentation in which patients can't consent. And the critical question then becomes, are you intervening therapeutically for the benefit of a patient? Because that's when it's ethical to do that within the standards of ordinary medical ethics. And then that turns on questions about who is the patient in this? Are we talking about a potential person who doesn't exist yet or an existing person with a deficiency? That whole framework, in my view, has largely not really been followed in the assisted reproduction debates, that we tend to kind of talk around these things and not try to think about or really rigorously apply them, especially as it applies to the beginning of life and the creation, the new creation of life that doesn't exist yet. It's uncomfortable in a lot of ways, and in some ways it's just a limited way to think about the meaning of what that act is.
Yeah, well, and your point about, you know, it's experimentation if you're doing it without patient consent, where you don't know the full implications. And I think it's important, too, to consider, you know, in these scenarios, the child that's being created through this hypothetical technology, they're not consenting at all. They have no say in what's happening. And I think that that's a piece that sometimes gets lost.
That's very well said. And a really crucial question to ask, an overarching question to ask about all of these technologies is, who is the technique for? In whose interest is it? And what is the nature of that interest? It is for the existence, the therapies that are licit, even if they involve risks or unknown side effects, are ones that are healing a detectable, a known deficit or disease or disorder within an existing patient. So, for example, most ethicists, including myself, if I want to flatter myself, an ethicist, would say that genetic engineering, so CRISPR, used to correct genetic illnesses or to treat genetic illnesses in adults and also in fetuses and even in embryos that already exist, if you're using it to treat them, but not to destroy them, then that's ethical and even good. There's a separate question about germline engineering if those changes become heritable, but there are all sorts of therapeutic techniques that don't involve germline changes that are as far as I know, basically uncontroversial and considered good by everyone, and should be welcomed as a welcome thing that that this type of technology has brought. But there are lots of exceptions to that where they are advanced under the banner as if they are that same kind of intervention, but they're really not. So a classic example of this is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, right? So you'll hear this talked about a lot in terms of, well, parents want to be able to give the best possible thing to their child. Well, that's basically a good sentiment and one we should largely applaud. But the way that pre-implantation genetic diagnosis works isn't by taking children who might face some deficit and helping them. It's by eliminating those children. So you diagnose ones who have genetic diseases, and you eliminate those at the embryo selection stage, which is it's a technique that can, frequently does, come along with IVF. It isn't always accompanied with IVF. But that's where that language starts to get very slippery, and where there is a kind of, once you start doing that, you open the door to other kinds of applications, right? Like maybe it's not just eliminating horrible genetic diseases like Tay-Sachs. Maybe it's things like you want to give your kid the best chance of getting into Harvard or getting a really high-paying job or being tall and athletic. What you're actually doing is setting conditions on which people get to come into the world and which of your children you allow into the world and which you don't. So I think that's where that form of ethical analysis and just understanding of the spirit of it, right, are we welcoming any child as a gift and then trying to help that child to the greatest extent possible? Or are we setting conditions on which kinds of lives are desirable and which are not, and not allowing the undesirable lives to get a chance at life?
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. As always, we like to wrap up our time with you with a little bit of Q&A. It's great to know what's happening in the news. It's so important for us to be informed. And we do need to understand a lot of these deeper bioethics issues, biblical issues, really, around child protection when it comes to making new life. But also, we live in the real world, and we know that you've got questions that have to do right with where you are right now. So Jen Friesen is here with me. She is my training director. She spends her time all week gathering questions from our listeners, and she has a few for us to discuss today. Welcome back, Jen.
Hi, Katie. Sometimes I like to just, peruse the websites, Reddit, different. You find so many interesting questions that people are dealing with, even online. But I actually have a question for you. Last week, we talked about the advent of artificial wombs and what do we kind of think the ethical implications of that would be. So go back to that episode, folks, if you didn't hear it. But I'm actually curious your take on the advent of robot help in general. I saw a clip. I don't remember what company it was, but it was like a robot that was folding clothes. Now, it was a person wearing a certain kind of gloves that was actually controlling the robot in the other room. But I would say we're easily a decade or less away from robots being able to handle, let's say, the majority of the household tasks. So what's your thoughts on, let's say it becomes affordable eventually for every household to have a robot or two that does your dishes, cooking, cleaning, yard work, it'll take over the majority of the household chores. And it seems like the Christian argument could be, hey, I have more time for people, I have more time for ministry, I have more time for my family. But do you think there's going to be some moral and ethical implications of not having to ever do manual labor?
Okay, I don't have the answer to this, but here's a few things that I know are true. I want the robot that's going to do the dishes for me. I mean, like, I am so grateful for my appliances. For a long time, my dishwasher didn't really work, and I ended up just kind of washing them all by hand anyway. My appliances, thank God. And actually, they talked a lot about how appliances like were the revolution that really helped women to increase their ability to participate in the family in a lot of ways, because so much of our time and attention was spent, you know, like slapping clothing against rocks and scrubbing it, you know, and then swishing it around in the river or whatever. I'm like, okay, so we've already, outsourced a lot of our work to machines. I want the machine that folds laundry too. Unfortunately, that's not the problem in our house. It's putting the laundry away. That's the problem at our house. There's things that are folded that just sit around for days or weeks and nobody puts them away. So give me the robot that'll put the stuff away. So we obviously always need to be aware of these technological advances. We never want them to circumvent our humanity. So that's the real challenge here, is machines can and do offer an awful lot to our lives in a lot of different ways. The challenge is when we start to substitute machines for relationships. And so it's very, very interesting because, like, I've been using ChatGPT quite a bit for research. And it's strange because ChatGPT is a form of artificial intelligence. And it's very polite and it's very affirming. Like, I will ask a question about, you know, some kind of impact that net zero policy is going to have on the global poor. And is that really going to outweigh the catastrophic impact that supposedly is coming down the pike because of CO2 emissions or whatever? And ChatGPT will say, "That's a really insightful question. You obviously care a lot about humanity, but you're thinking clearly about this issue." And I'm like, good heavens, you know, you are really trying to build a relationship with me. And it's interesting because I do find myself turning to ChatGPT for the efficiency of it. But then also, like, there is sort of this interpersonal kind of connection that you build. And it's like, all of us have got to be very on guard against that. And then obviously there is a really disturbing trend of substituting all different kinds of screen or artificial or manufactured presence for real life relationships. So we see that, you know, that's been creeping in for a long time through online pornography, where now you are no longer having a sexual relationship with a real life person. You're having it with somebody on screen. And now we have AI porn that probably is going to overtake, like, the OnlyFans market. And beyond that, you know, you have AI girlfriends where you can design your own girlfriend over AI. You know, you can design her physically. You can wire her personality. You can say, "Don't ever say no to me." You know, you can say, "I really want you to be able to have a great sense of humor." And so these are the areas where we have to really watch that machines are going to overtake relationships. And there's a huge temptation there because it's a lot easier to interact with ChatGPT than it is to interact with a real life person who maybe holds different kinds of views. It's probably easier. It's certainly easier to design your own boyfriend or girlfriend than have to work through the real life challenges that somebody with a personality that you can't design and can't control is going to bring to your life. So I want Jen, and I'm going to stop talking here because I know that you've thought about this and worldview formation wise. I mean, like, you are tip top. So I'll stop. Tell me what you think. Like, where is the line between yay machines and boo machines?
Well, and I like what you said too. ChatGPT is designed to sort of affirm us whenever we are asking questions, or when you correct it, it immediately takes your feedback and tries to do it the way you want. And so that's interesting. That's not like a real person. And the best friends we probably have are people who, you know, will not always affirm you. They are loving and kind, but they're going to say, "Ooh, I actually don't think you did that right, or you should have said it differently," whatever. And ChatGPT or AI is not designed to do that. It's supposed to be a tool that helps you. But thinking more about physical work and practical work, I agree. I liked your connection to, yeah, we use dishwashers and all those things. That's I don't see a problem with that. So I do wonder though, if we could offload almost all of our work, does that actually help humans in the long run? We're already struggling with being too sedentary, too on screens, not being outdoors enough, not being active enough. But, you know, people who have 10 kids or something, you have so much laundry, to have a tool that augments and helps you do work, it doesn't seem inherently wrong to do it. But I would agree, we would need to be careful how much we are relying on things. Definitely if we're using it, you know, I never touch my kids. I basically have a robot nanny. That could be a big, because that's replacing relationship. That's really important versus we have a robot that mows the lawn. You know, there could be some big differences there. So that is really interesting to think about.
Well, and all of these questions kind of come back to what does it mean to be human? And the answer is we're relational creatures. Like if we are not doing relationships, we are not actually tapping into what it means to be fully human. But the other aspect of what it means to be human is we're made to work. Like work was assigned and prescribed for us pre-fall. It's not a result of the fall. It's not a symptom of the curse. We are made for meaningful work. And we're made for work even when it's not meaningful sometimes. And that's the incredible thing about a relationship with the Lord, is even work that looks like it's mundane can take on incredible significance because you can do it unto the Lord. Because everything, the folding of the laundry, the taking out the trash, the being a garbage man itself, can be an act of worship unto the Lord. So I am all for machines that lighten the load when it comes to housework, because I do it for me in my world. It is a trade-off. Like I can either run to the store or I can spend a little more time with my kids. I can either pick up the house or I can get on the phone, with my daughter and FaceTime her and connect with her or whatever. And thank God for those machines that allow us to like talk directly to people that don't live close by. But again, we have to be really careful that all of these technologies and machines are facilitating relationships rather than replacing relationships.
Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, the next question, or I guess kind of case study, it's a true story. It's a woman who wrote on Reddit that she was asking the Reddit community, what should she do about a child who's about 2 years old, she thought was her son, she realized was now the product of her husband and one of her good friends who agreed to be a surrogate for her. So they went the route of a lot of people, you know, my husband and I can't have kids. My friend offers to be our surrogate. We're going to implant the sperm and the egg or whatever. And what turned out to happen was her husband had an affair with this friend. Then the surrogate, I mean, her friend's always over while she's pregnant and all these things, but it's because they're having an affair. But she's considering, you know, should I give up my parental rights to the child I have no biological connection to? I don't want to be married to this guy anymore. He's in a relationship with this other woman. What would you say for that kind of pretty crazy scenario?
What a mess. So that's the takeaway here, is what a mess. And obviously, like this is there's just going to be loss no matter how you splice this. Like there's going to be brokenness no matter which way that you go. But this is why we always need to look with very serious skepticism against any kind of technology, any kind of arrangement, any kind of cultural narrative that separates the iron triad of sex, babies, and marriage. Those three things must always go together. If sex, babies, and marriage always go together, there will be wholeness, there will be health, there will be thriving, there will be flourishing. If you separate sex from babies, like supposedly in this, I mean, they didn't separate sex from babies. He probably just went over and slept with her. And then they thought that this was actually a pregnancy through some kind of embryo transplant. Don't ask me how that was working out. But they separated, they thought they could separate sex from babies through surrogacy. And that didn't work out. And now, you know, the child has experienced fallout because they were not raised by their biological and gestational mother. And now the marriage is going to suffer probably through fragmentation and dissolution because they went outside the marriage, in essence, to create a child. And we see this too when we separate babies from sex, when we have this idea that you can take birth control and that that is going to prevent you from having children, even though you are participating in the baby-making activity for our species. And the result is a negative view of children, that they are not welcome unless you want them to be welcome, but also that birth control is not really effective at preventing birth so much of the time. And that's why we've seen an 8 to 10-fold explosion in fatherless children, because there's a lot of unplanned pregnancies resulting from the false promises of IVF, or I'm sorry, from birth control. And then of course, separating babies from marriage is a problem because babies need marriage. You know, there's a huge push, rightly so, in our country now for making more babies. We are far below replacement rate. We need to be at 2.1. We're at 1.6 and some change. And we are, many people in leadership are recognizing we are in a demographic crisis and they're trying to incentivize the creation of more children. You've got Elon Musk, who in essence is creating his own little harem. But we don't just need more babies. We need babies who are raised in the marriage under the relationship of their married mother and father. So this poor woman, this poor baby, this horrible guy, and this wicked best friend have created a terrible scenario. And it is because they believed that they could break that iron triad of sex, marriage, and babies.
Yeah. It's like you said, it's almost like the answer is that's why we shouldn't have done this kind of crazy thing in the first place. We only have a few minutes left, so let me hop to the third question. This guy says, my wife's been having an affair, or had an affair in the past. I've been trying to keep the marriage together. We have a five-year-old. But recently I heard on a podcast that kids raised by a single dad actually fare pretty well. Should I just cut my losses since I would be the primary caregiver, or continue trying to make an effort to fix this marriage?
Okay, so the data on fatherless homes is extensive. As our friend Glenn Stanton says, it's not a mountain of data that being raised without a dad is harmful. It's a mountain range of data that being raised without a dad is harmful. What is the data on children raised without a mom? And the answer is, we don't have very much because it's very rare for our species. It's very unlikely that a woman is going to abandon her baby right after birth. And certainly she can't abandon the baby right after conception. She needs to be there for the first 9 months of the child's life. And then after the baby's born, we have all these chemical processes that make it highly unlikely that she is going to just ditch and run. We do have a handful of studies that show children raised by single fathers. And based on those small studies, those few studies, it looks like harms to children are not as bad if they're raised by a single dad versus being raised by a single mom. But we do not have enough information to say we can extrapolate that to the broader population and say kids with single dads fare just fine. And they don't fare just fine. They just don't fare as badly as children raised by single moms. So what is the answer for you? I'm sorry, first of all, that your wife is not all in with you on this parenting project. This is why at Them Before Us, we oppose things like no-fault divorce because we actually think women like that should be punished. We think that they should have consequences, social consequences to the point where everyone looks at her and is like, what are you doing? But also legal consequences. She shouldn't be able to just divorce you and take half the money. Like, there should be consequences to breaking your vow. But what is best for the kid? Go to therapy. Get accountability. Work it out. Mend the marriage. Because any other alternative is going to lead to destructive, damaging impacts to the child. Thanks for being with us this week. We are so grateful that you give us some of your time and attention. What we talk about at Them Before Us is not just matters of how do we protect this individual child, what's happening in their life, but if you get on board the Them Before Us train, you are going to save our culture as well. So we have a campaign that is coming up at thembeforeus.com. It's called And Not Or, and it is that children need their mother and father, not their mother or father. And we are working to advance that truth across the country. And between Mother's Day and Father's Day, we are working to raise enough money and join and get some new monthly subscribers. If you support this mission, come to thembeforeus.com, subscribe, donate. We would so appreciate it.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.